Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Wygant against Jackson Board of Education. Proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. We are here today because the individual petitioners have suffered what we deem to be a constitutional injury by being laid off on numerous occasions from their employment as tenured public school teachers with the Jackson School District in Jackson, Michigan. The eight individual tenured teachers have, between 1976 and the present time, been laid off on a number of occasions from periods ranging from 6 weeks to up to 3 years of no employment for petitioner Wendy Wygant. Deborah Brzezinski, another one of the individual petitioners, has been laid off eight separate times during the past 9 years. The reasons for these layoffs are because of a race-based system for layoff contained in a labor contract between their employer and their union. We submit that this is an explicit use of race, imposed and sponsored by the state itself, the local school board being an agent of the state, being a political subdivision of the state of Michigan. And as such, we submit that it must be justified by the state, and that justification must be of the most compelling nature. We submit to the court that any minimum where the state seeks to assign job benefits and burdens based upon race, the burden is upon the state to show a state interest that has some remedial character, and we say, number one, the state must identify an injury, identify a constitutional injury that must be remedied at the expense of the individual petitioners. We say, number two, the state must show that the instrument or device or means chosen to remedy that identified discrimination are properly tailored to achieve that end and no other end. Number three, we think at a minimum, the state must do this before, not after, before it resorts to the use of race for determining job benefits. If the state does not do it before the use of race is assigned to determine job rights, how are the courts to review whether the use of race has a permissible constitutional objective and responds to a proper remedial purpose? So the justification should not be ad hoc or ex post facto. It should be done before the use of race is adopted. Now, we say that the use of race in this case has no remedial character, and as such amounts to a naked racial preference. We say that because —
Mr. Ferris, do you think that a school board has the right to look at its employment, its employees overall, and to look at the number of black employees it has and the number of black employees available in that immediate area for employment in jobs in the school and conclude for itself that the school hasn't done as much as it should have to employ black employees and develop a program to implement some effort to hire more black employees?
Justice O'Connor, we agree with that. Mm-hmm. And we think that as a predicate for properly conceived affirmative action, that is exactly what any employer must do.
Well, could it, as part of the program, adopt some kind of a layoff policy like this if it felt it were necessary to complete the implementation?
We think that there are some differences between affirmative action and recruiting and what an employer may do to incumbent employees. We think to take two public employees, one white and one black, and to treat them differently because of their race must, as I've said, bear a most extraordinary justification. And whether or not such a justification would be present in the abstract is, I guess, what your question goes to.
Do you think it's possible under the kind of inquiry I suggested?
I think, Justice O'Connor, there are, for example, school desegregation cases where the courts have found that in order to remedy ongoing constitutional violations in a segregated school district, and in order to have effective desegregation, that it may be necessary to make layoffs by race, but only if strictly necessary to remedy constitutional violations. And of course, there are no such constitutional violations in this case. We say there is no balancing to be done. Individuals, says the Constitution, have a right to equal protection under the laws. If there is some injury that must be remedied, or some other compelling constitutional value, then there is a balancing test to be done. But in this case, before the court, we pled in the complaint in the lower courts, in paragraph 21 of our complaint, that, and I quote, "There has been no finding of past employer discrimination in the hiring of teacher personnel on the part of the Jackson School Board by a governmental agency competent to rule on such matters."
What are you reading, sir?
Paragraph 21 of the complaint. It's recited at page 12 of our reply brief and is also contained in our original brief. Justice White.
May I interrupt you with one question? You stress the importance of remedying past wrongs, which is, of course, discussed a great deal in the cases. Would you deny the possibility that in the total absence of any past wrong and any desire to remedy anything, there might be a valid interest in the desirability of multi-ethnic representation on a teaching faculty, which they recite in this collective bargaining agreement?
To answer your question, Justice Stevens, I think there is, and I think the Bakke case was an example of that.
So that then it would at least be arguable, I'm not suggesting the answer, that that kind of justification might suffice in the absence of any need to remedy anything.
It might suffice, but again, and I think in the Bakke cases, there was a First Amendment interest there that the University of California Board of Regents had in an ethnically diverse student body. Well, but you could not deprive applicants to the medical school of equal opportunity
to
achieve that objective.
Put the Bakke case to one side for a minute and talk about this case. Why would it not be a permissible objective of the school board and the union to do exactly what they said in the collective bargaining agreement, that there had been trouble in the schools, and they thought a possible solution to their problems would be some diversity on the faculty.
We don't think that this achievement of this aim was for diversity on the faculty. We go right to the collective bargaining agreement, and on its face.
On its face, it says the desirability of multi-ethnic representation on the teaching faculty.
But the goal that that is aimed at is proportional representation, Justice Stevens, between the population of minorities in the student body and the teacher population. We say that that is an impermissible constitutional objective if you can only get there by depriving tenured teachers of employment rights. I'm going to talk about why that is an impermissible objective and why in this case it is also an unrealistic and unattainable objective. I don't think a school board should simply be able to say we desire multi-ethnic representation. The fact of the matter is the Jackson School Board has multi-ethnic representation. The Jackson School Board has consistently hired and employed minority teachers consistent with the available supply of qualified minority teachers.
Well, assume they had never had a black teacher before. Just to get, you suggest the means are excessive, and maybe you're right. Maybe the remedy is wrong. But I'm just trying to focus separately on the question whether the objective itself might in some circumstances be a legitimate, permissible objective.
If they had never hired a black teacher and did not have any, I think this would be a different case, and I think...
And there were never any available, so they didn't do it wrongfully in any sense. They just didn't happen to have any. And then I'm just wondering if they need to be remedying something in order to have a permissible objective.
I think, first of all, they do need to be remedying something. I think there has to have some remedial character. Whenever the state resorts to the use of race for determining job rights, it must have a remedial character. You can't deprive one individual of equal protection of the law just to achieve a worthy social objective that the school board may think is worthy.
Two people who had a vacancy and there were two applicants, a white and a black person, you would say the state could not choose the black just to increase the number of blacks on the faculty, absent some proof of discrimination in the past.
No, we do not say that, Justice White.
Well, you seem to.
First of all, this is not a hiring case, and we certainly...
Well, why would the hiring case be different? If the reason one person is hired and the other person is turned down is a racial reason, and there's no proof of past discrimination.
We think in the absence of any remedial effort, in the absence of any workforce analysis, in the absence of any underutilization of minorities in the workforce, and in the absence of any goals and timetables or standards, that yes, that would be impermissible for an employer, simply for the sake of race, to prefer one individual over another individual.
But you would say if the school board just thought that the blacks were underrepresented, that the preference for the black would be quite all right as a hiring matter.
We're saying if they
even though there had been no constitutional violation in the past.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there has to be a remedial character here. There has to be a finding of discrimination. I don't think that...
So that in my example, the state could not do that absent some proof of some past discrimination that had to be remedied.
That's correct, Justice White. I'm sorry if I misspoke myself.
And you don't
may I interrupt just for a minute? This discussion for the last three or four minutes has omitted entirely what seems to me to be the issue in this case, and that is the reverse discrimination against whites. In other words, people are laid off. Suppose you did have some decision below that there had been discrimination in the past. Would that justify laying off people to make room for the employment of others?
We don't think so, Justice.
Well, that has not been mentioned in the recent discussion.
And I think that gets to whether, even if you had some findings of discrimination in the Jackson School District and the hiring of minority teachers, which are not present here, that the instrument chosen here would still be impermissible because, number one, it is not properly tailored to remedy that. It's an extremely harsh instrument. You're talking about who is going to keep their job, and you're talking about making that determination on the color of one's skin. So we think, even if there were findings. But I want to make it very clear here.
Isn't it true that some of the teachers in your group got their jobs solely because of the color of their skin?
No, we reject that, Justice Marshall.
Prove it.
There is nothing to prove.
Didn't you have segregated schools in Jackson?
We think.
Didn't you?
We don't believe that's correct, Justice Marshall.
You never had segregated schools in Jackson?
The record goes back in this case to 1953, and we know one thing about the Jackson School District in 1953.
My phrase was ever.
Did
you ever have segregated schools in Jackson?
I can't answer that question, Justice Marshall. The record does not answer that question.
Did you look it up?
Question.
Were you interested in finding it out?
I was very interested in finding out.
Well, did you find it?
We have data.
Well, is the answer yes or no?
The answer is the record does not show that.
And you didn't find it?
And I did not find it. We know from two prior decisions and two related cases previous to this one, which we refer to as Jackson 1 and Jackson 2, that there is no discrimination in the school district as to minority hiring. We know that from a federal district court who made a jurisdictional finding in 1976. We know that from a county circuit court decision in 1979, where a county circuit court judge, Judge Britton, examined the history of the Jackson School District, examined the adoption of the race-based layoff system in the contract, which we challenge here today, which at that time minority teachers were suing the school board to uphold the preference contained in the agreement because the Jackson School Board had refused to follow it when it met laying off tenured white experienced teachers and retaining inexperienced minority probationary teachers. That happened in 1974. That led to the lawsuits in Jackson 1 and Jackson 2. In Jackson 2, the County Circuit Court found that there is no history of overt discrimination by the parties to this labor contract. Now, this contract was adopted in 1972. Let's look at the situation in the Jackson School District when this contract was adopted. Justice Marshall asked, did we have segregated schools in the Jackson School District? Certainly not in 72. This school district, over a period of time, had made an ongoing effort to keep up with changing housing patterns and had redrawn their school boundary lines and built new schools in order to effectively integrate that school district and had achieved that prior to the time that this contract was adopted in 1972. It had also set certain minority hiring goals in that school district. And those minority goals are discussed in our brief, and they concern the fact that they wanted at least two minority teachers in each of these small elementary schools, which had between 10 and 15 teachers each.
There had been some segregation. And if it was relevant, whose obligation was to put it in the record in this case?
The state's obligation, Mr. Chief Justice. We came forward and we said, we are being victimized by a labor contract which exhibits on its face an intent to discriminate on the basis of race. And we have suffered a constitutional injury because of it. And it is the state that must come forward to justify it. And obviously, to the extent there is no compelling justification in the record, the state loses. I simply make the point that in 1972, the hiring goals of the school district had been met. It was a healthy situation. You had the same number of minority teachers one would expect to find given non-discriminatory hiring. So this contract was not adopted as an affirmative action hiring or recruitment effort. It was adopted in 1972 in order to do one thing: to achieve proportional representation between the percentage of minorities in the student body and the percentage of minority faculty. If they had 25% minority students, they wanted 25% minority teachers. That is what the contract says, and I quote, "The goal of such policy shall be to have at least the same percentage of minority racial representation on each individual staff as is represented by the student population of the Jackson Public Schools." This contract says nothing about affirmative action hiring goals. It says nothing about the availability of minority teachers, the supply, if you will, who are out there to be hired. It says nothing.
May I just ask you, I want to be sure I understand your position. Do you contend that was an impermissible goal?
Yes, we do.
To get the same ratio of teachers?
Yes, we do. We say, and we quote Justice Powell and Bakke, that proportional representation is an impermissible constitutional objective and constitutes discrimination.
But the earlier hiring goal, was that permissible or impermissible?
It's a hiring goal, we think, may be permissible if you have some finding or determination of underrepresentation.
It's permissible to try to get the same ratio as in the employment market, but impermissible to try to get the same ratio as in the student body.
That's correct. Would
you explain why one is permissible and the other is impermissible?
Well, one has a remedial character, Justice Stevens. If, in fact, you have some determination that there is a shortfall of minority teachers relative to the supply, and if that is statistically significant enough that we know it didn't happen by accident,
then it's not a remedy that is for the benefit of any victim.
No, it is not, and that issue.
But nevertheless, it's permissible.
I don't think the court has to reach that question in this case, is whether it would have to be victim-specific. Certainly, there are no findings, victim-specific or otherwise. And we think the very reason this case is before this court is because you do not have findings of discrimination, either on an individual basis or on a group basis. But getting back to the labor contract, the contract says nothing about hiring goals or timetables. It says nothing about the school district's employment practices or procedures. What the contract is designed to do is achieve this racial balance, and what Article 12 is designed to do, as put by the district court, and again I quote, in Article 12, to be clear, is the contract provision that assigns layoffs on the basis of race. Based on the district court's findings, which are on page 32A of our appendix to the petition, quote, "The plan is designed to either, one, retain a sufficient number of minority teachers so that the racial composition of the Jackson School District faculty will roughly approximate that of the student body, or two, if that ratio has not yet been achieved, then at least to prevent a reduction in the minority-to-majority ratio," unquote. So what we have is a racial preference designed to achieve a racial balance and a prohibition against laying off minority teachers if that would reduce the existing percentage. Now, why is that an impermissible objective, which Justice Stevens has inquired previously? It's impermissible because there is no causal nexus or relationship between the percentage of minorities in the student body or the percentage of minority teachers. They're subject to totally different influences. There are any number of reasons why you might have a certain percentage of minorities in the student population. It might reflect changing birth rates. It might reflect housing patterns. It might reflect racial demographics. It might reflect parent choice. It might reflect population movement. Any number of reasons can increase or decrease the percentage of minority students in a school district. Now let's look at the percentage of minority teachers. What influences the percentage of minority teachers in a school district? The first and most important thing that influences the percentage is the supply. What is the available supply of minority teachers who are available to be hired by any school district? Taking the number, the most recent data we have, we know that in 1979 and 1980, all Michigan colleges and universities graduated a certain percentage of minorities with education degrees, whether it's a bachelor's, whether it's a master's, whether it's a PhD. And assuming that every minority that gets an education degree wants to go into teaching, we know that the available supply of minority teachers is at most 11%. The school district cannot be expected to hire and retain more minority teachers than are available out there. Yet they have an objective that says we have 27% minority students, we want 27% minority teachers. And until we get it, we're going to deprive other tenured teachers of their civil rights in order to get there. That's why it's an impermissible constitutional objective. And again,
But as applied to just hiring, you wouldn't make that same argument, I take it.
Well, again, I'm reluctant to answer questions on hiring because we say this is not a hiring case. This layoff provision is not even designed.
Well, I know, but the court has to be mindful of the whole picture in resolving cases, so that's kind of unrealistic to decline to answer, I think.
I think to answer your question, Justice O'Connor, I can tell you what the practice is in this country today. Whether it's under the Office of Federal Contract Compliance or whether it's under the EOC guidelines, every Fortune 500 company in this country hires according to race. They all do it.
Well, is that unconstitutional to do that?
We think, well, the Constitution, of course, does not govern the private sector. They do that. However,
within the public sector is what we're talking about.
That's correct. They do that under the Office of Federal Contract Compliance. The regulations, and it's 41 CFR, Part 60, tells these employers you must have a utilization analysis. In other words, you must look at your workforce. You must see if your supply of black engineers is equivalent to the number of black engineers you could hire given the supply available. And if there is a disparity in your workforce, and if it is a significant disparity, then you must adopt goals and timetables. And employers do that, and they hire according to race to reach those goals and objectives. This plan before this court could not meet the standard in the private sector under the OFCCP. Why not? It uses race to determine and assign job rights without any utilization analysis of its workforce, without any determination that they're not hiring or retaining minorities according to the available supply, without any goals and timetables to place some kind of appropriate limit on what's being done here. So to answer your question, we can say what's being done in the private sector under OFCCP and under the ostensibly under this court's holding in Weber. In the Weber case.
Counsel, this was called a contract, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was. This whole problem is a contract.
It's in a labor agreement between the petitioner's employer and their union, Justice Marshall.
And the union is 80% white.
That's correct, more or less. Well, the fact of the matter is, we don't think you should look at the race of a union. We think you should look at whether or not people are voting their economic self-interest. That's what a collective bargaining agreement is all about. And to say that this is, or suggest that this is somehow proper because a majority of the union members voted to ratify it after it was put in there without their knowledge, to suggest that it's constitutional for that reason, we reject that suggestion. We say that the United States Constitution guarantees individuals equal rights under law, and the constitutional guarantee does not depend on whether one has enough clout to negotiate for it at the bargaining table.
How much clout 20 has over 80%? I have very different clout.
They have no clout to protect their individual rights, Justice Marshall, and that's why we're before this court. Their rights.
You're saying that the 20% of the union should not have the rights that were negotiated by that union.
I'm saying that.
Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that regardless of what the employer and the union do, regardless of what they do, Justice Marshall, The Constitution says you shall have equal protection under law. The collective bargaining process is not competent to determine someone's constitutional rights. And we think that's simply a given, and we would cite to the court the case of Alexander versus Gardner Denver, which is a 1974 decision of this court, which I believe is 415 U.S. 36. That was a Title VII case, and the issue in that case was, can a union and an employer waive an employee's Title VII rights?
Counsel,
of course they can't waive
it. It goes all the way back to Tunstall and Steele back in the 40s. That's when that was determined, that a union and an employer could not.
You're correct, Justice Marshall. Thank you.
About that. But that doesn't apply to this. This is where it was a union contract that was carefully negotiated and agreed upon, and you want to upset it.
Justice Marshall, first of all, we want to upset it because it's unconstitutional and it deprives the petitioners before this court of their constitutional rights. And we object to any characterization that this was carefully negotiated. And we
or not, if it violates the Constitution, your position is that it can't stand even if it's 100%.
That's correct. Even if the process was entirely good and you had an entirely above-board process by which this was arrived at, it still violates the Constitution.
Your time has expired now,
thanks,
Mr. Cody. Mr. Sussman.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. By 1972, this Court had charged school boards to step up to their 14th Amendment duties to end discrimination and integrate their schools, advising boards to evaluate the total facts and to review a wide range of factors. Now, this is exactly what the Jackson Board did as a part of a comprehensive four-year study. The board knew that the district had discriminated against students and faculty. The Jackson Board further knew minority teachers would be necessary for faculty integration and were educationally essential to aid students who will live in a pluralistic society. The educational policy was sound and the governmental interest was compelling. Article 12 was but a part of total integration. It was arrived at bilaterally. All the teachers' views were represented. It is clearly designed so that the gains made would not be in vain and destroyed in the event of a decline in total student enrollment. Article 12 did not place the burden on any one group. It was believed by all the parties to be equitable. All parties' interests were represented. The collective bargaining process itself was a significant safeguard because of its adversary nature. Now, Article 12, which is part of the overall layoff language, takes race into account. However, it is but one part of a layoff clause which takes into account as well curriculum and program. Now, no animus on the part of the board has been, or the union, has been alleged by the petitioners. There's been no allegation that this language was enacted to harm these petitioners in particular, or whites in general. This is part, clearly, of a remedial effort to cure the vestiges of discrimination and to enhance the educational opportunities of Jackson students. Now, the rights of employees were balanced against the needs of a sound educational system and were enacted by responsible parties.
Mr. Susskind, before you proceed,
yes,
did I understand you to say that the board in 1972 knew it had been discriminating against minority teachers?
It certainly did.
Well, did it take that position in the litigation before the district court in the first case? It denied it at that time.
Certainly did. And in the first case,
it did deny in that case it had discriminated.
In Jackson 1, that is correct.
Yes.
Right? Now, Jackson 1, bear in mind, however, and Judge DiMaggio, I think, makes this very clear.
Involved the same parties to this case as in this case.
Different issues, however.
The discrimination issue wasn't different, was it?
Justice Powell, first of all, when this case was tried before Judge DiMaggio, it wasn't a question of whether or not Jackson was going to integrate its schools. And I think Judge DiMaggio made it very clear. There was no effort made and no proofs put in to prove a 14th Amendment claim. The plaintiffs in that case, don't forget, were the union and the black teacher simply attempting to enforce the labor agreement.
But whatever the issue, the board claimed it had not discriminated.
Your Honor, not only did Jackson,
right.
That is certainly correct, because you know, Jackson not only had voluntarily integrated, and when we were sued here, very frankly, the Jackson board at that point didn't want to open itself up, if it didn't need to that type of an admission and the possibility of other lawsuits.
While I'm interrupting you, let me ask you this question. Has there ever been any judicial decision of discrimination by the board?
No judicial one. The board, I think...
Has
the board
there ever been any judicial decision?
You had, of course, the NAACP.
The answer with respect to this board is no, isn't it?
Your Honor, there's been no judicial determination.
Can you
tell
me
the case?
This
was a voluntary effort to integrate,
right.
And there was no reason for a trial.
So there's been no judicial determination.
That is correct. For those reasons, the Jackson board. Now, let me also say, as to the facts in the stipulated record, Justice Powell, Jackson surely knew what was going on there, but didn't want to flail itself publicly either, frankly, when we were establishing the stipulated record for this case, and certainly not in the matter before Judge DiMaggio in that issue. It wasn't a question of asking the federal court to write this contract language. The contract language existed. The characterization that because Jackson 1 occurred is somehow supportive to the petitioners, I think, is an error. And a reading of the Judge DiMaggio's opinion, I think, will support it. One, as I say, they weren't attempting, the plaintiffs in that case weren't attempting to prove a 14th Amendment claim. They didn't have to prove a 14th Amendment claim. No one was asking them to, a court to rewrite this type of language. They already had it. The only issue there raised by the board, and in fact, I think Mr. Odie kind of mentions it here himself, is the question between tenured teachers and non-tenured. Now, that was resolved in the state court under Michigan state law. The following year, all the minority teachers, in fact, had tenure, and the board didn't take that position. Even though that litigation was pending, the labor agreement collectively bargained was followed. So I think that's, with all due respect, a red herring on that particular issue. It seems to me that the board, having been told by this court, and I'm not saying that you told Jackson specifically, but it seemed to me that the clear word that was sort of getting out, particularly, I think, after Brown 2 and Swan, was, look, I don't mean to be paraphrasing perhaps what was going on up here, but it seems that the court had perhaps had it with some of the cases that kept coming up here with the same issues being raised. And we certainly felt that you would have to look, where did you have your students placed? What kind of faculty do you have? And if you're going to integrate, this wasn't just one issue you'd look at. You'd look at where the students are, where the faculty is. And I certainly find it as one of the things we should have done and indeed look at is, as long as we're doing all of these things under our 14th Amendment duties, should we not, after all, this being an educational institution, understand what it might do for us educationally and culturally? And I think the decision... Once you had, as an example, stipulated to the NAACP complaint in 1969, I think everybody got looking at this and said, gee, you know, this is not only the right thing to do, but it's the right thing to do educationally. Let's have a culturally and ethnically diverse faculty. And no one seems to quarrel with the competency of the board to do that. And no one seems to have suggested that there's anything the matter with it. So I guess the main flaw we seem to have here is that because we don't have a really good record is because we voluntarily integrated. Now, I would have been like Dayton or like Columbus or Detroit and refused to integrate, to not obey this court's order until somebody sued us and made us do it, we'd have the record you'd want. But Jackson voluntarily integrated, and therefore it doesn't have the record. So we're sort of in a catch-220 situation on that. We either seem to obey what this court wanted us to do and integrate, and evaluate all those factors. You know, this wasn't some hasty decision. It was done over a four-year period. And it wasn't just the board. It was the Jackson board. It was a Blue Ribbon committee. It was an ad hoc committee of faculty and administrators. It was a minority affairs office internally. You'd had the NAACP complaints. It seems to me that in 4 years, one could make this sort of a determination. Now, I agree with Mr. Odie. It is not a hiring case. Article 7 are goals, simple goals of what they thought would be nice. It is Article 12 that tells you how you lay off.
Mr. Susskind,
yes, yes, sir.
Normally classifications based on race are constitutionally suspect. I suppose you would agree with that.
I would certainly want to look at all the facts, the remedial nature.
They're suspect, right?
They should be looked
classifications at. Based on race?
As the district court, of course, did.
And normally, I guess the court would look to see whether the government can demonstrate a compelling state interest to justify such a classification if it had made one. Now, what is the compelling interest that the school board asserts here? Is it to maintain a faculty-student ratio, or is it some other purpose? What do you rely on today?
Let me make it very clear that what Jackson was looking at, both in 1972, and I'll be glad to answer that further if the court should desire
me. Well, just a short answer in response
Certainly.
To the question.
It was looking at the fact that it had to integrate and look at the faculty and the students. And I'm talking about the students by placement and the need for integration and where the faculty was placed and what they'd have to address on that issue. And at the same time they were dealing with the question of integration, they also were dealing with the issue of educational soundness for a diversified faculty and dealing with that problem. Now,
so
if you're asking me which is more important,
the board does rely essentially on the faculty-student ratio and the role model rationale.
Justice O'Connor, I didn't say that, and I didn't mean that. I think what I was looking at specifically was its duty to integrate, how we'll go about that integration, and certainly at the same time, and we make no apology for
integrate
it, educationally
in hiring. You're talking about hiring employees, integrate hiring?
Now, maybe I'd just like to, if I may for you, lay out some facts that I think the court should be looking at as perhaps we're carrying on this discussion. You know, before 1954, there was not one minority teacher in the Jackson Public School. 250 teachers were hired during the 50s. One of them was a minority teacher. Now, during that period, let's take 53-54, you had 9,966 students, 355 teachers, and one of them was black. In 1961, you had 12,611 students, 515 teachers, and 10 of them were minorities. Now, by 1971, you know, this is stipulated, too, in the record, they went on an intensive recruitment program to bring teachers in. Now, in 1972, okay, you actually had the integration plan, which now went to busing and went to the allocation of the faculty. You just had those hiring gains. Now, the reason it's addressed in Article 12 is if you're not going to do something about layoff, is it going to be considered by the public
well,
as a good-faith effort to integrate?
You know, maybe I can't get an answer, but I really would like to know what the compelling state interest is that you're relying on for this particular layoff provision, in a nutshell.
We had just dismantled a segregated system. We had just moved to a unitary system instead of a dual system. And to protect the gains made, it was going to allow us to do that as we looked at what we certainly thought were some of the factors we ought to be looking at, like faculty, and wanting a diverse ethnic faculty. To protect that, we had to have Article 12. It's the only place
of faculty-student ratio that the board thought was appropriate.
You know, at that point in time, Justice O'Connor, when you look at the number of schools that we had and the number of minority teachers we had, about the first time you were going to get a layoff, you had just gone through this hiring effort to bring in these teachers. If you're not going to protect them in layoff, you're really going through an exercise in futility in hiring them in the first place. We wanted them there. We had to have a method of protecting them. And, you know, everybody's concerned about fairness, you know. Jackson, having nothing else to do with its time, hadn't run around just simply discriminating against whites at random. When we decided why this layoff program was needed, okay, we knew that minority teachers, at a minimum, had at least 5 years less seniority. If you're going to apply straight, quote, inverse order seniority, those gains were going to be long gone pretty quickly.
It's a knotty problem, and it leads to the next question, which is what means can be used to achieve a compelling state interest if you find that there is one for a race-based provision?
Well, certainly as part of integration, and I think it's, of course, obviously up to this court to decide, but we were integrating that district. I don't think there's any mystique in this record after all those 4 years. And everything that district went to, and by the way, it certainly was not welcomed with open arms by everyone in Jackson. But it did integrate, and this is one of the things that was involved in integration. That's what's the compelling state interest from that standpoint. The educational interest is equally important to the board. I can't separate them for you because we couldn't separate them for you. And the people involved here, the kids, is what was good for these children in this educational program, is what the board was concerned with, not whether or not teacher X or teacher Y was laid off. And these teachers, let me tell you this, and I think have been highly responsible because they have subordinated seniority. Not only, and that's why I don't want to left with some belief here that the only thing we're talking about is Article 12. It is subordinated to protect program. It is subordinated to take care of such things as elementary art, music, and the like. It is subordinated to take care of curriculum. And if one of these teachers had been laid off because we had to protect Latin, we certainly wouldn't be here. No one would say that because these teachers who bargained to subordinate seniority for the good of the program and for the good of the kids educationally, that somehow there was a constitutional violation. But for heaven's sake, in this case, to have diverse faculty, we also mentioned the nasty word race. And so if one of them happens to be laid off for that reason, now we're here constitutionally. Yet to deal with the issues presented to the district of what do you do about integrating and looking at your faculty and having a diverse faculty, you had to address it somewhere in the layoff clause or you'd be right back to where you started from in short order. And, I don't know where else you would address it but in a layoff. Now, you know, Article 7 is indeed a goal. It's a hiring policy. It's not a term and condition of employment that has to be bargained about. Layoffs do have to be collectively bargained, and they were. And these parties reviewed it in 1977. This contract's been ratified 8 times.
Mr. Siskin, can I ask you a background question? At the time the layoffs started, and as I understand it, they went on for a period of several years, or were the people hired and put back and then laid off again. But at the beginning of the problem when you had to decrease the total number of teachers, what is the maximum seniority of the people who were laid off? How seriously did you affect it?
Justice Stevens, I can't honestly tell you that. I can tell you that the majority teachers certainly had about, as I say, an average year, or the minority teachers have an average of 5 years less seniority. I think the problem is a lot of this applies to what program. You could have a many-year teacher end up being laid off without any regard to the racial question.
Because she was teaching the wrong subject or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Because if you're going to lay off, for instance, 10 people in the high school, it may turn out that your 10 least senior is your math department or your entire foreign language department. Now, that's why you have to really look to the makeup of that particular layoff. It may end up that somebody with 10-year seniority, as an example, ends up getting laid off without any relationship to the question that brings us before this court today. And that's why it's really impossible without, sitting down and laying that all out at any particular point in time and say, well, this is why it happened. Because that may really not be why it happened at all. But, when these parties looked at this issue, I think they very clearly recognized, what's going to happen when you subordinate your seniority. Not only in 1972, but each time they looked at the contract, and certainly in 1977, as I say, when you're taking, when the teachers, and by the way, by the time you get to 77, these layoffs are now getting chronic because you're having a rather significant decline. And here you are looking at, first of all, what is needed in the building? What is needed in a particular program? Elementary music, elementary art, okay? So these parties certainly knew what they were doing. And Article, the language from Article 12, which really hasn't changed the principle at all, was certainly there. Now, all the teachers involved that we're discussing are all qualified. No one has ever suggested they weren't hired in an individualized way. Merit isn't involved. One of the issues certainly this court, I believe, is focused on in reviewing this problem is somebody stigmatized. Well, if they were later.
Oh, but race is.
So a variety of other factors, Justice White.
Well, not in these layoffs. Not in these layoffs.
Well, I have to tell you that I don't think that's absolutely correct, sir. Of the other factors
wouldn't be
in
much
making
the case
this
here. Wouldn't be, that case wouldn't be here if it weren't, I wouldn't think.
Well, that's true, but all I'm saying is when you're looking at the total layoff, Justice White, you're looking at all of these other reasons. Now, quite frankly, you've got to recognize this. If some of these other problems, for instance, protection of some of these other programs hadn't been what they were, that teacher might have been laid off. So to suggest very honestly that the only reason was that, I think is inappropriate and inappropriate in the record. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there isn't anything in Article 12 at all that indicates there is any tie between Article 12 and the minority student population. Article 7, as I said, is a goal. Now, when Moses came down with the Ten Commandments, they were commandments. This is a goal. And it doesn't have anything to do with Article 12. Sure, this is it's a hiring position. We have a non-discrimination clause in that labor agreement also. And this is what we'd like to have. You know, we're never probably going to get it because of, you know, what the goal is because of the decline in teachers. But when you go to the layoff clause, all it does is protect against elimination. It limits, the, you know, not numerically, but by a percentage against this minimal number with less seniority from being eliminated. It doesn't say anything in there that you can't lay them off. White teachers and minority teachers are both laid off. None are immune. They're not immunitized by this by any means. So I think the attempt to take Article 7 and say, well, this is going to be here forever for this reason, it would not be a proper interpretation, respectfully, of that labor agreement. Now, let me suggest that no bad faith in anyone against either the union or the board, I think the court's well aware of that, has been alleged. This is a question of diversity for the benefit of the students. Solely, as we're looking at it from an educational standpoint, and to suggest that there is no compelling state interest to end a discriminatory system does not seem to me to be in keeping with what this court had been saying in the 70s, and certainly up to the time when Jackson had first integrated. And, you know, this is not a situation where these parties are reviewing this on a regular basis. It has a definite lifespan, as does anything else in the labor agreement. To suggest sort of in a whisper that somehow there is something wrong with the process, and I'm not saying the court ought to yield constitutional questions to a labor agreement necessarily, but I would rather expect where you know it's part of integration, you know it's part of that plan, and you know why you've done it, that rather than a whisper that perhaps there's some impropriety in that process, there'd be some real allegations and some real proof, and the petitioner's never put in anything in this case, including the pleadings. In the sad history of what really kind of occurred after Brown 2, Jackson, I think recognizing the time had come, elected to obey this court's decisions and the law by voluntarily integrating. In doing so, it didn't wait to be sued, only obeying the law when it knew it had to obey it. Now, the language under attack here certainly arises, as we have already discussed, perhaps longer than we should have, from a compelling governmental interest, and one which we say certainly is educationally sound. You know, I think this court has indicated that school boards have a specialized ability to perhaps deal with these educational issues. And we feel it furnished students with an ethnically diverse faculty so they could learn to live in a pluralistic society, and that certainly is one of the goals, and it's certainly still true today. Now, through education, the time is going to come when society will be able to really be truly colorblind and judge people, as I think this court would want it to, without regard to race. This, however, is not the time we'd suggest to move back 20 years. It's time to move forward when these issues that you have here aren't going to be before this court. And certainly the best place for this matter to be dealt with are in your educational halls. Now you're going to deal with that if we aren't going to have this type of diverse ethnic faculty to work. And is the board going to be second-guessed in its good faith effort when it was supposed to be looking at whether or not it should integrate, when it did so over a four-year period, and it attempted to address the problem through the layoff clause, not unilaterally, but with its teachers, through the adversary process of collective bargaining. You know, this is really a situation. It's a little bit different. This wasn't a court-ordered integration case, and it certainly wasn't court-imposed language. These parties not only agreed to it in 1972, but these competent teachers, you know, all of whom are well-degreed, have felt it a good idea to continue this right through to the present date. And I'm aware of this case, too. Now, I don't necessarily say you ought to yield it to them, but I would certainly suggest in a constitutional review of the issue that there are some pretty strong process considerations that these people have indeed not been abused. You have a good faith effort of competent parties designed to protect the gains made, not to harm these petitioners or anybody else. We would suggest on that basis that the language of Article 12 found so offensive by the petitioner should not be offensive, found offensive to the 14th Amendment. As you know, this case at bar here was presented on stipulated facts. It was stipulated to the district court. No factual question was ever raised before the Sixth Circuit. We believe that the governmental interest is compelling. So is the educational interest. We would ask this court to affirm the opinion of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Thank you.
May I just ask you what may be a frivolous question? I was interested in the fact that minorities described in the collective bargaining agreement include blacks, American Indians, Orientals, or persons of Spanish descendancy. How in the world would you determine who is a person of Spanish descendancy?
Well, I did write that. I think Hispanics.
Sir?
Might have been,
I didn't hear your answer.
I didn't write that. Hispanics may have perhaps been a better term. I guess we just didn't think about it, Justice Powell, at that point. But I think we had. I think we were looking at having Hispanics.
I'll ask you one more question.
Certainly, sir.
Would Asian students think that an American Indian would be a role model?
You know, let me say one thing about this role model question, if I may, which I think will give you an answer to your question. You know, we weren't hiring black teachers to teach blacks. We had that problem. That's exactly why we couldn't. We wouldn't hire an American Indian to teach Indians either. What if we wanted an Oriental or an American Indian? That's part of a diverse faculty. And if you want people to exist here in this ethnic scheme, in this pluralistic scheme I think that we have, if you had an all-white district and you wanted to have some black teachers, I think that might be a very good idea. And in Michigan, with the competition we have with the Japanese, let me tell you, I think it might be a real good idea, except for the fact we might be sued by someone who got laid off, that if we might not get some Japanese. Now, so far, I will admit that we haven't been under attack by the Indians other than perhaps by these petitioners, but I really think that an ethnic diverse faculty we think is a very good idea. I would ask this court to allow us to continue to do that.
Gentlemen, the case is submitted.